Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all today about Plinthite. One of the co-authors that I want to recognize is John Kelly. Some of you all know John. He's recently retired from the NRCS, and over the last several years led a dense soil property groups, and some of the discussions and the findings from this group really provide the underpinning for the discussion today, and I appreciate John's and others' efforts with regards to this. Plinthite first was used in soil taxonomic circles in around the 1950s, and much of what we owe to our understanding of plinthite was developed by Ray Daniels in the 1970s and associated experiment station personnel. Plinthite is derived from the plinthos, which is a Greek word for brick. It's an iron-rich, humus-poor material, mixture of clay and quartz that occurs in greater than 2 millimeter aggregates. It occurs in many forms, from polygonal to platy to nodular, and it turns out the shapes of plinthite have a lot to do with the geomorphic setting where it forms. Typically, we tend to find platy shapes of plinthite on more gentle surfaces. Nodular shapes of plinthite tend to be on more undulating forms. And also, the shape has a major impact on the way that plinthite behaves and affects soil properties. Platy plinthite provides more impedance to permeability and actually lends itself more to perching. As a matter of fact, Daniels first suggested in the 70s that about 10% platy plinthite will perch water, and nodular really has a much less effect. I'll touch on this a little bit later. Plinthite is firm to very firm moist, but hardens when dry. And this next part, changes irreversibly to ironstone upon repeated wetting and drying, has probably caused the most confusion in identifying this material consistency, because you almost have to be able to predict what it will do in the future. And it also has led a little bit to a subjective nature on how we identify plinthite. But over the last few years, through the operations of this dense soil property groups, they have implemented a cementation component into the definition of plinthite, which I think is going a long ways forward to how we recognize this material consistently. And I'll touch on this a little bit more in the future as well. All right, from a WRB standpoint, plinthite is concentrated in plinthosols. You might recognize the plinthosols are soils that have over 15% plinthite in some horizon within the upper meter and a half. Plinthosols from a global basis are estimated to be mapped on 150 million acres. But if you add just soils that contain some plinthite, the acreage, of course, goes up appreciably. Plinthite is concentrated in humid regions around the equator, portions of Southeast Asia, India, Africa, South America, Australia. And in particular, of course, I'm interested here in North America. And in this country, it occurs extensively in the coastal plain from Virginia to Texas, in portions of the southern coastal plain, western coastal plain, and ridge portion of the Floridian coastal plain. Currently, there are 50 series that are correlated to plinthite taxa. These 50 series are mapped on approximately 13 million acres. And in order to be in a plinthic subgroups, which all these 50 series are, or some derivative thereof, you have to have greater than 5% plinthite before a meter and a half. So using the analogy previously, obviously, if you consider soils that just have some plinthite, the acreage estimates of soils with plinthite goes up appreciably. Now, of these 50 series, 80% of these soils are ultrasoils. Over 80% of them are in loamy, coarse loamy, or fine loamy families. And 70% of them are considered to be well-drained or moderately well-drained. Now, from a conceptual standpoint, this is the concept of a head-on with plinthite for an upland well to moderately well-drained scenario. The soil forming processes that largely go on include lateritization, as you might imagine, a subsurface accumulation of iron, and of course clay eluviation-alluviation cycles. They're not mutually exclusive. If we think about an enrichment in iron in the solum, clay translocation with iron can certainly promote this occurrence. When we look at a conceptual pedon, if you will, what we typically see in our region is shallower in the solum, a concentration of ironstone. Remember, ironstone forms repeated wetting drying of plinthite. If you think that these upper portions of the solum are subject to more, at a higher degree of wetting and drying, then it would make sense that perhaps ironstone would be concentrated in the upper part. You can't, with the nodular ironstone, preclude transportation and other sorts of things and lag concentrate phenomena to do this as well. Plinthite tends to be concentrated in VTV horizons, as they're recognized, and concentrated above this lower material that consists of a very contrastingly, highly contrasting modeled that has sometimes been referred to as the brick. You see this over massive portions of our coastal plain and is certainly indicative of a past weathering regime, paleosol type features, and these things largely control the hydrology of the landscapes. It's these features where plinthite is concentrated in the upper and above that give rise to the redox cycles that largely drive the contemporary formation of plinthite that we see. Again, I've mentioned to you this stuff has been called brick at times. There were studies done in the 60s and 70s that suggested some of this stuff even has some phragic characteristics. By and large, there is some brittleness associated with it, but they are not phragic properties that we associate with true phragic characteristics. So when we look at plinthite formation, we can't discount, of course, the lateralization. Now, you recognize in the southeastern coastal plain, we had a lot of sediments were laid down in fairly gentle landscapes that over time, as these things downcut and develop drainages and you get uplift, the interior of the inner flumes typically become the most poorly drained soils on these landscapes. Iron is solubilized, moves to lower portions of the landscape, and potentially even through the formation of this brick material that I mentioned before, we have landscape inversion processes. Now, we also can't discount the fact that we have some of the oldest geomorphic surfaces in the U.S. in this part of the world. Owed to the concepts by Rui and applied by Daniels in the 1970s, we recognize that we have geomorphic surfaces which date all the way from Miocene or possibly older down to younger periods. Plinthite tends to be concentrated on the older geomorphic surfaces. And this is probably due to several reasons. But one thing we can't discount with this is the fact that if we look at past times, particularly during portions of the Pliocene and Miocene, temperatures were estimated in portions of the Pliocene to be 1 to 5 degrees warmer and even more humid than what we currently exist today in this region. So we have to discuss what degree of lateralization is due to relic processes and what degree is actually going on in a contemporary manner. And I think this can't be discounted in the formation. So again, plinthite's on the older geomorphic surfaces, typically in the interior of the interfluves. As you get to the edge of these things, you typically have the red edge effect. For some of you all are familiar with these landscapes. As you start getting to more sloping lands and slopes increase up to over 8%, you typically lose plinthite. This is probably due both to a younger geomorphic surface and also drainage characteristics. Now, a study we did several years ago was evaluating this underlying material, again, where plinthite tends to occur in the upper part and above. And we looked at 7 pedons, all within plinthic taxa, in the Georgia coastal plain, and we measured the hydraulic conductivity of these overlying BT horizons, the BTV enriched with plinthite, and in this underlying material. And typically what you see is the BTVs and the BTs are 3 to 6 times more conductive than the underlying material. The reason for this is largely due to just less area for flow path, as you can see from the die staining patterns here at the bottom, through this underlying material that doesn't allow water to permeate as much as it does through the upper material. Now, if you look in the voluminous literature on plinthite, not as much in the U.S., but certainly globally, it is recognized that there is some degree of perching that also certainly promotes the formation of plinthite. Most of the data that we have seen suggests that the perching is not associated with the plinthite itself, but is really associated with this underlying material that controls the hydrology of these landscapes. The plinthite is a manifestation of this perching, at least in the contemporary standpoint. A little bit on the field identification. This is largely, again, owed to work by Daniels. These things occur in yellow to red aggregates, 10YR to 10R hues that are separable from the matrix. Again, firm to very firm, moist, hard when dry. A moist aggregate can withstand rolling when you separate it from the matrix, but can still be cut with a knife to separate it from plinthite from ironstone on the more cemented end. And a moist or air-dried aggregate will not slake in water. Okay, some of you all are familiar with slake tests, particularly with regard to phragic characteristics. They definitely play a role in plinthite identification. This was a table developed by John Kelly's Dense Soils Group. On the left, where we talk about slakes with water, are what we call the hard red models, the iron accumulations. I know we don't use models for contemporary, but the iron accumulations. And then progressing to the right, we have the stuff, the plinthite and the ironstone, that does not slake in water. And this chart can be used to identify each component. The thing I will point to here specifically is this cementation criteria, extremely weakly to moderately cemented, covers plinthite particles. Before 2008, there was no language in our concept of plinthite with regard to the degree of cementation. John Kelly's group has inserted this, and it's in the 11th edition of the Keys, and I think that's going a long ways forward to how we identify these materials. If you don't know offhand, extremely weakly to moderately cemented corresponds to about 8 to 160 newtons of disruptive force. And again, I think this puts us on a lot more consistent basis. Okay, slake test or aggregate disintegration. For those of you all who have used this stuff with fragile characteristics, you realize that it depends on many things. The size fraction that's used, whether you used air-dried or moisture-dried material, whether the sample is agitated, and how long you subject the sample to submergence. It's been done many ways with regards to evaluating plinthite over the last four decades. In 2009, most of you all are familiar with the Soil Survey Field and Lab Methods Manual, the report number 51 that was published by the Soil Survey, that included a technique authored by John Kelly and Mike Wilson, slaking disaggregation for identification and semi-quantification of cemented materials. This is a standardized slaking test that was developed out of this dense soils group to get us on a standardized technique for slaking characteristic of these plinthic and associated type materials. So again, through the works of these groups, we have a cementation criteria implemented. We now have a standard slaking technique. And again, I think this is going to go a long way as we discuss getting this all standardized. Since there have been techniques and slaking techniques done where plinthite has been separated from the soil matrix, you might imagine that these things have been characterized. This is a chart of several studies that have been done in the past. In particular here, we're looking at the diathionite iron of plinthite versus the fine earth fraction. If you notice, the left is the diathionite from the plinthite, and the third column over from the right is in the soil fraction. You typically see about a 3 to 4 times enrichment of iron in the plinthite particles versus the fine earth fraction. I will also point out that none of the diathionite iron quantities, as you see these averages reported here, are over 10%, and I'll show you why that's important here in a minute. So what are the implications of soils that contain plinthite? Certainly these things are older soils, so there's the associated poor fertility. You have iron, higher quantities of iron, so you have things like phosphorus fixation. Ferrolysis associated with the iron leads to acidity. You have mechanical strength issues with the plinthite and associated features in the cementation. Soil abrasion when you have ironstone, particularly on tillage implements, close to the surface. And, of course, any time you have pararocks or rocks in the profile, it affects water holding capacity. I'm going to touch more specifically on these three entities below. First off, hydraulic conductivity. I already mentioned this before. It's been well established that plinthite has some effect on hydraulic conductivity. Here's a graph of two pedons of measurement of hydraulic conductivity with depth. The lines denote where the BTVs are in this particular these two pedons. Please note that the NCSS estimates are to the right, and actually the actual measure values are a little bit less than the NCSS estimates. But the thing I will point here is if you use a pedotransfer approach or Rosetta, which is commonly used to estimate hydraulic properties, a Rosetta estimate will be 3 to 5 times higher than what the actual measured conductivities are for these soils with plinthite and horizons with plinthite. So that's certainly suggesting that it is having a major effect. Probably the thing that leads to the most confusion is how do we interpret plinthite from a hydromorphology perspective. We've done a study within the last several years where we had 11 pedons and wells and piezometers instrumented in the Alabama coastal plain. Of these 11 pedons, 7 of them were in plinthic taxa. All of them had some plinthite in it. And I think there were 30 horizons that had some plinthite included within these 11 pedons. And, of course, you can take averages, and we did this over a 3-year from, I think it was 2005 to 2007. Precipitation at that time was near normal. Of course, we always fight that to a certain degree. But you see this general progression of the average annual percent saturation in the horizons that have these features. And by an average estimate, plinthite occurred in horizons that were saturated approximately 20% of the time. But, of course, averages don't mean that much. And in actuality, plinthite was found in horizons that were not saturated at all at any portion of the time to over 60% of the time. So plinthite, as a contemporary indicator of seasonal high saturation cannot be relied upon exclusively. It has to be used in combination with other features. One thing that we could do, though, is separate those pedons by landscape, where we have the better drain high terrace and upland pedons versus the concave pedons which would be receiving water, and you see a large dichotomy in what Plinthite is telling us from a drainage class standpoint. In the high and dry pedons, Plinthite was in horizons that were saturated less than 10% of the time, in landscapes that received more water over 50% of the time. Again, suggesting that there also could be some relic nature to the Plinthite we're observing in some of these soils. Real quickly on the taxonomy, because this is important. The WRB does recognize a plinthic horizon. A plinthic horizon has 15% plinthite. Okay. And in the plinthite requires over 10% diathionite iron. As I've shown from some of the past studies, no study that I've seen in the U.S. has had this much iron in it. This is something that we're going to need to get worked out as we work on universal soil classification, because there is a different concept. We recognize laterite is a huge topic of extreme importance, but right now I'm talking more specifically about plinthite, and there's a different concept globally about what these materials are. In closing, there's been recent improvements in the definition of plinthite. We have a standardized slaking technique that will help us in uniform characterization of this material. We recognize that there's an extreme relic concept to our laterite profiles that occur in the southeastern U.S. There is contemporary plinthite formation, but there also is an extreme past history in a lot of these pedons. We may want to reconsider a plinthic horizon of taxonomy, which was suggested 3 years ago and tabled. We do have to work on the extractable iron limits, and we need to work, obviously, globally to make sure we're talking about the same material between all entities. So.
Thank you very much, Joey. Thank you.